Shopify grows your business no matter how far or big you grow. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Whether you're selling your fans' next favorite shirt or an exclusive piece of podcast merch, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
This is a crowd podcast. We Didn't Start the Fire, the only podcast started by me, Billy Joel.
Hello. Before we get into today's episode, Tom and I have a little message for you.
We certainly do, Katie. And the message is this. Our last competition went down so well, we're going to do another one. Mm-hmm. So this is your chance to win some merch and win big.
This time we're asking you to spread the fire. All you need to do is go to our socials, Twitter and Instagram, and make sure you're following us at Spread That Fire, and then get creative.
You could upload a photo showing us why you love it or where you listen to it. You could get a facial tattoo of Katie on one cheek and me on the other.
Which cheek? That's what I want to know. I would suggest perhaps an interpretive dance that you film. Just be creative, because we're bribing you. I mean, there's a prize. We will pick two winners, our favorite slash the most creative or funniest fire spreader. Plus, there'll be a random winner as well, because, you know, we're nice like that.
Oh, we have a Katie. These two lucky people will win, get this, our entire merch bundle. Let's go through that. One of Katie's legendary damp cloth Utopia tea towels, a poster specially signed by both Katie and me, a beautiful fire bookmark crammed with fire quotes, and cartoons of our favourite fire lyrics, and a silky soft t-shirt in your size. You can see all the designs at spreadthatfire.com.
Just make sure that you tag at spreadthatfire on Twitter or Insta, and that you're following us.
The competition is open as soon as Katie makes this klaxon noise.
Kahooga!
And you have got until Monday the 13th of June. So, get those creative juices flowing. Alrighty, on with today's episode.
Buddy Holly.
That'll be the day. That day is today. It's Buddy Holly time.
Hello again, and welcome to episode 68 of We Didn't Start the Fire, the history podcast based on Billy Joel's pop opus that sets the syllabus to school us on the headlines, heroes, and villains of the late 20th century. I'm Katie Puckrick.
And I'm Tom Fordyce.
Tom, how did we get to where we are today? Billy Joel thinks it might have something to do with Buddy Holly.
Oh, Katie, I bet he does. How could he not, as a rock and roll musician, how could he not think it would have something to do with the man who probably looks less like a rock and roll star than anyone else of the era?
Yeah, I know. And the thing is, I was first pretty much cognizant of music after Buddy's time. I'm younger. And I really learned about him sort of, it was a pop culture reference once removed. The song by Don McLean that came out in the early 70s called American Pie that referenced The plane crash that killed Buddy Holly along with Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper, and he called that the day the music died. Did you remember that song?
Very much so, Katie. I think anyone who's ever had ears has at least once heard Don McLean's American Pie.
as it goes on for, like, I don't know,
exactly.
8.5 minutes, 9 minutes. And it actually was the second single I ever bought. I think I was about 9 years old or something. And I do remember in my fourth grade class, my teacher, Mrs. Cum, K-U-M-M, probably
the poor woman.
It's probably the oldest kids that she could ever teach without being ruthlessly riled on that one. But anyway, so Mrs. Cum set us a task, which was at the end of the year, we were all to create a little memory book of cutout construction paper that was tied together with pieces of yarn. And then we passed it around to all the other kids in the class, and everybody wrote a little, like, I'll miss you, have a great summer kind of thing. And because everybody knew that I was on my way to moving to Moscow, because my dad was stationed there in the Air Force, Tom Butler, who I had a severe crush on, wrote the following. Bye-bye, Miss American Pie. If you don't die, God will cry, and so will I. Bye-bye, Miss Russian Queer. And you know what, Tom? Do you know what I understood immediately from reading that? Tom Butler loved me. Oh, my God, he loved me. So, you know, I was simultaneously outraged, impressed, and flattered because, you know, it was snappy, it was economical, and, my gosh, it was funny.
Yeah, and, of course, to put that word into context, Katie, at the time, when he's talking about Russian queer, he just means you're slightly strange, doesn't he, because you're going to a country he's never been to.
There's a whole lot of pejoratives wrapped up in that. But, yeah, basically, he thought I was an oddball, but also he was trying to disguise his nine-year-old need, intense need for me. How about you and Buddy Holly? What are your memories?
So my memories, the first time I came across Buddy Holly, Katie, was one step removed because the Beatles cover Buddy Holly's Words of Love on Beatles for Sale. I was a massive Beatles fan from very, very early in my life. So my first experience of Buddy is Paul McCartney doing his best Buddy Holly. But then my dad is a man who believes that popular music stopped moving forward with the release of the Animals cover version of the House of the Rising Sun in 1963. To him, Buddy Holly is right in the sweet spot. So he would often play Buddy Holly as I got older. And also my mum, my quirky mum, would randomly take songs and song titles, take them out of context and sing them as she walked around the house. And one of them was Buddy Holly's Maybe Baby, which she would sing every time she saw a baby, which because we were Catholic, I was one of five kids, she was one of eight kids. All her brothers and sisters had a huge number of kids. She was singing Maybe Baby all the time.
Complete with a hiccup?
Complete with a hiccup, yeah. So that's our experience of Buddy Holly, Katie. I'm glad to say we'll be speaking to someone today who has a far greater level of expertise in Buddy than you and I, and that is Chris Smith. Chris is a professor and chair of musicology and director of the Vernacular Music Center at Texas Tech University in a town called Lubbock, which we will soon find out is very, very important in Buddy's story. Chris is also, from the look of it, a master musician. Chris, there are so many instruments that you play. There are some that I haven't even heard of before.
I'm not sure whether I should be proud of that fact or rather embarrassed by it. But yes, I do play some esoteric instruments.
So we're going to talk all about Buddy Holly. We're going to talk about his early days in the town of Lubbock. We're going to talk about his rise to fame. We're going to talk about his tragic early demise because he does only have 18 months of fame in his lifetime. But first of all, Chris, for people who know Buddy, for people who might only come across him occasionally, just tell us why he has such charm. Tell us why he has the hold he does even all these years later.
Well, thanks, Tom and Katie. I'm not sure I could speak to why he's charming, but I am familiar with that really quite common trope that Buddy doesn't look like a rock and roll star. But if you put the horn-rimmed glasses on John Lennon or Hank Marvin from The Shadows upon Paul McCartney himself, he actually looks a whole lot more like a rock and roll star. Because Buddy looks like a guitar player. He looks like not the fellow who was the captain of the football team. He looks like the guy who stayed home on a Friday night or a Saturday night and sat on the edge of the bed and listened to records and learned how to play the guitar. It's basically the difference between the front man qua Mick Jagger and the guitar player, qua Keith Richard.
Chris, we've already had a glimpse into the birth of rock and roll thanks to Billy Joel with his inclusion of Johnny Ray in the song Elvis Presley, and he references Rock Around the Clock, Bill Haley and his comments. And with the exception of Elvis, I guess it's hard to see from our current vantage point what was exceptional about the somewhat tame early rock sound. I'm trying to get an idea of what was new and different about Buddy Holly. I was looking at some clips of him on the Ed Sullivan Show. And was it the first time that the public at large had heard that rockabilly sound in the mainstream? Or was it that idea that he was very accessible with the nerd chic?
I think it's possibly a number of factors. I think some of those may be involved, Katie, but I think there are other reasons as well, because we should remember that rockabilly had been heard already in recordings by Jerry Lee Lewis and by Chuck Berry and quintessentially by Elvis. In fact, Elvis is a huge influence on Buddy, and they actually got to be friends when Elvis came and played in Lubbock. I think that Buddy's appeal was somewhat different because Buddy, he was an extraordinary creator and an extraordinary innovator in a number of different areas. We can get into that in our conversation. But really what Buddy did was Buddy showed how it could be done. He showed a way it could be done. And I think maybe showed a path forward for people who couldn't imagine themselves as Elvis or couldn't imagine themselves as Bo Diddley, but could imagine them as a tall, skinny kid from the hinterlands who wore glasses and played the guitar. And made a new set, a whole range of new archetypes for what rock and roll could be in the 1960s.
Let's talk Lubbock. So Lubbock is a town in Texas that you know particularly well.
Yeah, I teach music history and ethnomusicology at Texas Tech University in Lubbock, which was founded in 1923 as Texas Technological College. More saliently to Buddy, Lubbock is Buddy's hometown. His family all came from here. His primary school, the Roscoe Wilson School, is about a block and a half away from my house in Lubbock, Texas. I've played in the radio studios upon which he hosted programs. I met his family. I met his brothers. We just lost his older brother about a year and a half ago. I'll call him a man, but he was a young man of his place and of this place, which in the 1950s was socially, politically, especially in terms of theology, a pretty darn conservative place. At the time that he was growing up, there were 200 churches, mostly Baptist, Methodist, Catholic, and Church of Christ. And there were no bars because it was a dry city. So you had to go out in the county in order to get you some beer to drink.
So he is the youngest of four children. His father, Larry, works in construction. His mother, Ella, is a housewife. It sounds like he had quite an itinerant early life, Chris, in that he had, 16, 17 different addresses in Lubbock before he reached manhood?
The family moved around a lot, a bit within the town, but they were all very much embedded. As an extended family, they were embedded in the town and people knew them. They were part of what's called the church family in the Baptist church. And so I think there was some movement, but I think Buddy is very much of Lubbock. And part of what drove Buddy in his sort of voracious creativity and innovations, the same kind of thing that drove a lot of later Lubbock musicians, which is that I think it was Butch Hancock, who was one member of the Flatlanders, who said, well, you know, in Lubbock, you got to either play music or go crazy. And I suspect it was even more the case in the 1950s.
And so what drives him, aside from his mental health concerns, to take up the guitar?
His whole family were musicians, and they had a family band. And so playing music in the Baptist congregations, it was considered completely okay to play music. But he came up hearing and playing mostly what we would now call country music. Lubbock is a town on the territory band circuit, like Kansas City or Oklahoma City, where groups like Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys would tour. And so Buddy had the opportunity to hear a lot of music, particularly what we would now call kind of Western swing dance music. And some of his first gigs were in Western swing bands.
And talk to us about him meeting Elvis.
Yeah, that's a sweet story. And you can find just little bits and bobs of footage on YouTube of this. Elvis played in Lubbock in 1955, a couple of different times at various nightclubs, at the local county fair, Coliseum. And so by the time Buddy heard Elvis the second time, I think the second time that Elvis played, Buddy and his trio actually were influenced by Elvis. And there's a bit of footage you can find on YouTube of Buddy and a crowd of high schoolers backstage at Lubbock High School with Elvis, talking to Elvis.
What was the conversation? Is there any archive information about this?
Yeah, there are stories about Buddy and his friends taking Elvis around to the after-hours clubs. I don't know that anybody sat down and ever wrote a news story about it. There's a wonderful story here in Lubbock, which I personally, because of my own interest, find quite moving, when Little Richard played in Lubbock. Now, Little Richard is African-American and a much more flamboyant personality even than Elvis. But when Little Richard played in town, Buddy got to meet Little Richard as well, and they got to chatting, and Buddy offered to house Richard overnight at his parents' house so that he wouldn't have to sleep in a cheap hotel room in a segregated town. And that, to me, that anecdote is very indicative of a way that Buddy was always reaching further, reaching for more musically, reaching for wider horizons of experience, and especially reaching beyond racial boundaries.
I love the idea of Little Richard as a house guest for your conservative mum and dad. That would be, Katie, quite the house guest.
Quite a pajama party, Tom.
So I want to geek out a little bit here, Chris, on, first of all, the singing style that Buddy develops, which is really, really distinctive. And then let's go into his guitar playing. But first of all, the singing, it's been described as hiccuping. It's unique to Buddy, isn't it?
Buddy comes out of, particularly out of country singing. I'm thinking particularly of Jimmy Rogers and also of Hank Williams. That hiccuping thing, yeah, that is a funny vocal technique that he employs in a couple of songs. They happen to be a couple of the most the best known songs, but I think of him as Buddy as really kind of a country singer. And I just have this completely unscientific surmise that hiccuping thing might possibly evolve from Jimmy Rogers's blue yodel.
Yeah, it's like a truncated yodel in a way.
In a way, yeah, I think so.
Okay, and then let's talk his guitar style and also his choice of guitar. It sounds like he has borrowed some money quite early in his life from his family to buy a Fender Stratocaster. Now, the Stratocaster is pretty much the rock and roll guitar, isn't it?
In fact, on our Buddy Holly Museum here, which has a number of his instruments and his personal memorabilia donated by people around the town, it actually has a bespoke video from Sir Paul McCartney, who came to Lubbock for the opening of the museum. The Stratocaster was very much a space-age kind of guitar. It was very much associated with surf music. The other rock and rollers didn't play Stratocasters. It was like the Telecaster, which preceded it. It's a country guitar, a guitar that was used in Bakersfield music and used by dance band musicians, really. People who needed to be able to play a very stable, solid instrument in relatively high-volume situations. And so, yeah, the Strat becomes iconic of Buddy, and it's actually on the wall of the Buddy Holly Museum here in the old train station.
And what was his playing style? He has this loud guitar. What does he do with it?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. I could go on, as Tom said, I could geek out about this for hours, although, you know, disclaimer, I'm not a specialist in Buddy's guitar style. But I think there are a number of ways in which Buddy was, despite the fact that he had this somewhat less flamboyant stage persona than, say, Little Richard or even Elvis, Buddy is absolutely an innovator in a number of ways. And in terms of guitar, Buddy invents the power trio. He invents the idea that you can have a complete band consisting of guitar, bass, and drums. And he plays the way that he does to answer Katie's question. He plays the sort of combined rhythm and lead style, and the songs are very much based around these iconic riffs that you can tell Buddy came up with the riff and then wrote the song around the riff, which is a rock and roll strategy as well, right? Keith Richards writes the riff and then Mick makes up the lyrics, right? Well, that developed for Buddy because Buddy came up playing not even in a trio with guitar, bass, and drums. His earliest musical collaboration was with the drummer J.I. Allison when they were 14, 15 years old. And next door to the museum that's housed in the old train depot, the city purchased and moved the small house and the attached garage in which Buddy and J.I. taught each other how to play.
Wow.
They were playing guitar and drums, and with no bass player, no other accompanying instruments. And so what Buddy figured out was a way to use the guitar in this really very composed, very orchestral fashion, this way of this riff put together this way, these parts put together this way. This is the whole orchestral structure of the song. It's the same way that Eddie and Alex Van Halen learned to play in their family garage in LA, just guitar and drums. And there's a particular way of playing that evolves in which Buddy is trying to cover all the parts.
Yeah, I'm thinking about White Stripes as well, you know, more recently in the indie world, that same thing with the guitar and then the drums. And it's just, it's very skeletal, but very powerful.
Yeah, Katie, I think that's really true. And I think it's an example of a lot of the ways that rock musicians, pop musicians, vernacular musicians operate. They operate to maximize the resources that are available to them. If they only have guitar, bass, and drums, they use guitar, bass, and drums. If they're Elvis's band, if they just have acoustic guitar, electric guitar, and stand-up bass, Bill Black learns a way to play the bass that makes it exceptionally percussive. So it's sort of, you know, a needs-must kind of situation. And but it does lead to this thing where Buddy develops this really orchestral style, which is a huge influence upon people like Hank Marvin and the Shadows, more indirectly, people like George Harrison and the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix. You know, these are all people who pick up on the idea of the guitar as an orchestral instrument. And that's what I think, that's, I think, one of Buddy's great gifts to pop music.
Do you want more crowd podcasts?
Let me tell you about the Crowd Stories channel.
It's where you can find all of Crowd's documentaries.
In one place.
And for just £1 a week, they're ad-free.
Addictive documentaries like American Vigilante.
I'm a monster hunter. It's what I do.
And Murder in House 2.
I know you know what happened. You want to keep it to yourself, you suit yourself. You're going down.
Unbelievable investigations into government cover-ups.
Your daily reality is the fact that at any moment when the guard comes along, he might just pull out his gun and shoot you in the back of the head.
And immerse yourself in the stories of death of a rock star.
Just search for Crowd Stories on Apple Podcasts.
And hit the subscribe button.
See you there.
Now, Katie, we've been keeping our fingers crossed. Chris, do you happen to have an instrument close to hand with you today?
I do.
Katie, it's happening. Chris, what would you be able to show us on your instrument which would tell us more about the style of Buddy Holly?
I could give you Peggy Sue.
And that's all just done on your acoustic guitar. So by the time that gets onto the Stratocaster, it has even more intensity, I imagine.
Yeah, and in that period, they played on, because they were playing on very, very small sound reinforcement systems, they played on very, very big amps because they were used to playing in clubs where there wasn't much in the way of a PA. And so that would have been this huge sound. And remember that not only did Buddy learned to play guitar in this drums and guitar duo, but J.I. Allison developed his own drum parts in that same setting. It's, again, it's like Eddie and Alex. It's this way of playing where, or of Jimi Hendrix and Mitch Mitchell. You know, it almost didn't matter who the bass player was. Bass player played a really crucial role, but the bass held things together while this sort of orchestral percussion and guitar thing happens. The same thing happened in Cream with Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker. It's a model for how to think about the trio. And Buddy invented that.
And the drummer, J.I., he's the drummer on Peggy Sue as well?
Yeah.
I mean, that is incredible, that driving. It's almost like the Burundi drummer's style. It's just so tribal and so forceful and so propulsive. And it's a little kind of punk rock.
Yeah, J.I. loved to play on the toms, right? That boom, yeah. Dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum. The remarkable thing I think about a lot of pop music on your side of the water as well as mine is that these are people who, like jazz musicians before them, they didn't learn this music in school. They had to learn it by ear. They had to invent it. Buddy had huge ears. Buddy is one of the most omnivorous musical musical landscapes I've ever imagined. When I first started working on Buddy's music, I found much more in the music than I would have presumed. The influences of Norteño music and Tex-Mex music and German polka music from Central Texas and country music and Western swing, as well as blues and R&B, upon which Buddy really cut his teeth.
And when he is slinging his guitar and hiccuping and those tom-toms are pounding, what is the audience doing? Like, how are the kids dancing to this? How are they responding?
Yeah. Well, Buddy's very first gigs were playing for Western swing bands for a legendary West Texas Western swing band leader called Tommy X Hancock, who just passed a few years ago. Remarkable musician. And Buddy first played in 1949. So people would have been dancing in the late 40s and early 50s. They would have been dancing Western swing, jitterbugging especially. By the late 50s, there's a wider range of dance styles. And I was just reading a thing the other day, just parenthetically and contemporaneously, that the twist, Chubby Checker's The Twist in the late 50s, is one of the first dances that didn't stipulate that you had to be partnered with somebody. And so you could get out on the dance floor to dance to The Twist or other songs of the period, and you could dance by yourself. You weren't dependent upon having a partner. And that's really kind of transformative, and that also points forward to the 60s for sure.
Yeah, you could individually let your freak flag fly.
I love this idea, Katie, of the audiences around the South who are getting, to be honest, an unbelievable musical treat at this point, because it's not just Elvis, it's not just Jerry Lee Lewis, it's Chuck Berry, it's Gene Vincent. I suppose it's the Everly Brothers as well, Chris. I mean, to be young and out and about at that time, what a gift.
Yeah, I think that's another fact. You're absolutely right. It's an incredibly rich time for music. And I'm not one of those old guys who says, oh, it was richer then, it is worse now. But I would say that there's a magical moment that happens after the Second World War, especially in the States, where there's this comparative boom of prosperity. The invention of the social category of the teenager. Marketers they invent that term in the early 1950s in the States because they recognize there's this entirely new clientele to consume things, including music, especially music on the 45 RPM single, and even more on radio. Because in this period, radio was not constrained by wattage, and so you could have an enormously powerful radio signal coming from Nashville or from Memphis or from Miami, 50,000 watts and audible in Greenland at night.
Wow.
And what that meant was that kids could hear anything, especially white kids in the suburbs could hear black music. And so the reason that somebody like Buddy in his way, or Bob Marley in his way, in approximately the same period, they're hearing American R&B and blues from these, and country music from these very powerful radio stations in the South. And it's a completely non-segregated space. It's this virtual space where anybody can listen to anything on the transistor radio under the covers at night.
So, Chris, I want to talk to you about how did Buddy come to seize the reins of his destiny? What thrusts him into the national sphere?
I think that's a really remarkable story, too. He had a bit of a misfire, or maybe we could call it a false start. His first recording sessions in early 1956 were actually in Nashville. There were sort of different attempts by different producers and labels to kind of figure out a way to package Buddy and put him out there and find him an audience, really. And it didn't really happen. One of the things that is not so apparent about Buddy is that Buddy was an enormously curious, highly intelligent and aggressively ambitious person, not an obnoxious person, but he had an ambition that was far beyond that of Lubbock, Texas, or even of the dance club circuit of the American Southwest. And so it's when Buddy develops a relationship with Norman Petty, who owned a studio in Clovis, New Mexico, that he kind of hits Buddy Mark II. It's when he puts together his trio. It's when he's with a producer who isn't trying to shoehorn him into a kind of country music kind of approach. And that's when things like That'll Be the Day are recorded by Norman Petty. And it's in late 56 and 57 that Buddy arrives at he kind of cracks the code of what it is that he's going to do.
Let's get into some of these huge songs then, Chris, because everyone will have their own favorite. It's a remarkable canon to put together in such a short period of time. What are the songs that for you are the game changers, the ones that move it all on?
Well, I have to say that I didn't come into my current job in Buddy's hometown as a Buddy Holly fan. And so I would not have been so aware of some of that music. Some of my favorite stuff of Buddy's is actually quite late, including some of the material that he recorded as demos. When he had moved to New York, he recorded these pieces as demos. And he kind of expands his palette. That'll be the day, of course. It's an amazing piece of writing, but the guitar part on there's a Freudian slip. There's a Bo Diddleian slip. Who Do You Love, a.k.a. Not Fade Away. That's an amazing guitar part. An amazing translation of what Bo Diddley did on his open tune guitar that Buddy adapts and finds a way to kind of reinvent. And so over and over again, what I hear Buddy doing when you get deep into his catalog is that he encounters a music and he begins to discover a way that that music style characteristics can be transmuted into an original pop song, which is the same thing that Paul McCartney does so well. For that matter, it's the same thing that the American songwriter Stephen Foster did, to hear these very wide range of styles and say, that one could work this way, and that one could work this way, and that one, this one could work this other way. So I like it when Buddy's covering black music, basically, because that's the roots that I share with Buddy. I'm another white boy who loves African-American music. And that's the thing that most, I think that it's African-American music that showed Buddy a way out of Lubbock, Texas, both experientially, also professionally, and also musically.
And speaking of taking Coles to Newcastle, Buddy played 7 nights at the Apollo in Harlem. And apparently the story goes that the audience was a little surprised to find out that he was white, although I think he doesn't sound that soulful necessarily. Do you know anything about this event?
I do a little bit. And I'll back up just for a second, Katie, and say that, you know, there were people in the black community in Memphis who thought that Elvis was black. So, you know, that miraculous medium of radio made it possible for people to listen across presumed racial boundaries. There were a whole lot of people who thought Chuck Berry was white, yeah, because this is as the writer Peter Guralnick, this is a world of music sound in the American South, which represents what Guralnick calls the Southern dream of freedom, namely and especially the freedom to operate across racial boundaries. He played at the Apollo. The Apollo, of course, was the absolute epicenter of African-American live entertainment. If you made it at the Apollo, you could make it anywhere. And if you crashed at the Apollo, you were in a very large company of other people who had crashed at the Apollo. James Brown did a remarkable record, I want to say in 1962, I think, called Live at the Apollo, an LP, which is a phenomenal live recording of someone who absolutely owned the Apollo. James Brown and the Famous Flames. Buddy struggled a little bit more, but he did something that I suspect he had done in a lot of dance clubs. When he was struggling, when he was having trouble getting across to the Apollo audience, they played Not Fade Away, and everybody recognized it as a Bo Diddley tribute, and that's apparently the song that they came to close their sets with. They would close with Not Fade Away because of the Bo Diddley beat.
Right, so he's kind of he's sort of pandering in a way, but he's also saying, look, I recognize my debt to this tradition, and here it is.
Yeah, I would say, I don't know if I would quite call it that, you know, because he did what every musician does. He adapted to circumstances. And that's one of the kinds of virtuosity that goes unremarked. But if you're a dance band musician, I will tell you, you're a dance band musician playing in rough clubs in the American Southwest, in places like Lubbock, Texas and Amarillo, Texas, you learn how you can move your thing in the direction that the audience is looking for. And for all that Buddy looked like a kind of nerdy Mr. Science kid, Buddy was a tough kid, and Buddy could fight, and Buddy was had a lot of, I would say, moral certitude about the path he was following. And it's what took him out of Lubbock, Texas, in the teeth of that era's racist presumptions.
I was going to ask Chris what it was like for audiences in the United Kingdom when Buddy tours over here in 1958, because if the seeds of rock and roll have already been planted, he has got his watering can out at this point, because Paul McCartney will hear him, John Lennon will hear him, Keith Richards will hear him. But Based on what you've just said, I almost want to twist that around now. It must have been equally incredible for Buddy Holly, the kid from Lubbock, Texas, to be playing in these places in Europe.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I make no secret of the fact that I think that Buddy had an intellect and a set of ambitions which were going to take him out of Lubbock, Texas, no matter what. So in a sense, I find it, you know, remarkable and lovely to think about Buddy and J.I. and Tommy Alsup, their guitar player, and Joe B. Malden. I love the image of these 20-year-old, 21-year-old kids in London and getting up to the things that 20-year-old young men do. But I also think that Buddy, I don't know, Buddy had this remarkable capacity to own situations. So when he felt that he was being shortchanged by his record company, he was prepared to take action to find out about whether that was that kind of malfeasance was occurring. When it was time for him to change from one record company to another, he did that. When it was time for him to leave his management, he did that. When it was time for him to move to Manhattan, he did that. So Buddy was a citizen of the world, even if it took him until he was 20 to get beyond his own home zip code.
Well, talk about him being the master of his destiny and very decisive. When he met Maria Elena Santiago, he proposed on their first date.
Yeah, that is the story. And they were actually quite a good partnership. They had, I think, quite a clear shared understanding of what they wanted for Buddy's career. And another in one of the many ways in which Buddy is a real innovator, in addition to being, you know, I'm arguing the inventor of the power trio, in addition to being really one of the very first rock and rollers to write almost all their own songs, in addition to being this orchestral guitar player, in addition to being someone who, like Frank Zappa, would successfully later on, and the Beatles would unsuccessfully later on, Buddy took control of his own catalog. He understood early about controlling his copyrights. And I think that he was kind of a master of his destiny. And, you know, I'm not sure that I would advise any 21-year-old young man to propose to a woman on their first date, but I would regard the partnership that he formed with Maria Elena, the brief partnership during his life, and in her very long and deep commitment to his catalog since his early death. I think he chose well. And I think that relationship, like so many of the ones I'm talking about, was something that it was about Buddy taking his world outward and to wider horizons.
And also it was noteworthy and I guess taboo that she was Puerto Rican and Buddy was white.
Yeah, it was. I mean, there was still, as we sadly know, there's still real racial prejudice in my country, and it's very fierce. It was maybe a little bit more explicit in the 1950s. Maria Elena had trouble. She had trouble with some of the longtime Lubbock folks who were like, well, where did he find this woman and why did he marry her? And, you know, and then after his death, you know, there was tension there because Maria Elena she's been very clear about safeguarding his legacy when sometimes people wish to exploit his legacy, and she's not having that.
Let's move towards the end game, because unfortunately for Buddy, it happened so quickly, Chris, you know, this very brief meteoric rise he has, and it seems to begin around that thing you've discussed, around a desire to safeguard his financial future. He signs up for something called the Winter Dance Party, which is going to be a tour across 24 gigs in the middle of the Midwestern winter. He does it for cash initially, does he?
Yeah, he did, although it was very common to play on package tours. That's the way that most of the promoters of the period ran their artists' careers. You didn't tour solo. You toured as part of a package. That's how Buddy came to the Apollo, for example. It's also unfortunate that in this period, no promoter, no manager, no record company was really thinking we're gonna lay a foundation for the long haul with this person. We're gonna lay the foundation for a 4 or 5 decade relationship with this person. At this period, it was still very much get in, get out. You know, this is another pop music cycle that's going to be a flash in the pan. What made those kinds of tours difficult was when the promoter was trying to cut corners and save costs. And yeah, they were touring in unheated former school buses in the middle of winter in the upper Midwest. And it gets, as someone who's lived there, it gets damn cold.
So it's getting colder and colder on this tour. It sounds like the sort of tour that is massive fun when you're watching and massive fun when you're playing. And in between, it really does get pretty brutal.
Yeah, it is pretty brutal. And it's hard. It was strings of one-nighters. You know, you play one night, you go into a hall, you play one night on your package, you get back out, maybe you get a few hours sleep in a hotel if you're white and can get into a hotel. And then you get back on that damn bus, usually with dirty laundry and cold and bad sleep. And it's hard work doing one-nighters. Was then, it is now.
So he's on this package tour with Richie Valens, who was famous for La Bamba, the Chicano star, an innovator in his own right, and the Big Bopper, who was famous for Chantilly Lace. Hello, baby. And so they're all on this freezing bus. And talk us through what happens on the night of the fatal plane crash.
Well, it's a, you know, you guys referenced Don McLean earlier, and your theme man Billy Joel has referenced this as well. It's a kind of decision that somebody makes when they think, I just need to get a couple of hours sleep, or I just need to do my laundry, or, you know, there's this terrible story that at least one person on this tour, the Winter Dance Party in January of 1959, at least one person on that tour actually had actually suffered from frostbite, because that's how tough the conditions were. And, you know, given that Buddy and J-Hi and Joe B would make the 100-mile drive from Lubbock, Texas to Clovis, New Mexico in 1 hour, a 100-mile drive in 1 hour.
What?
Yeah, they had this they used to have this competition where they'd get out of the dance gig in Lubbock and they would try to drive fast enough to the New Mexico line where the time zone changed, that they could arrive in Clovis before they left from Lubbock. Huh. Well, you know, you're 20 years old, you're driving a giant Cadillac, or you're 20 years old and you're freezing and people are getting frostbite on a tour bus. You think, sadly, you can think, well, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen? You know, if I get on this plane, I'll have a chance to do some laundry before we do this next gig. Let me get on this plane and go do the laundry and, you know, make sure the hotel rooms are right for my bandmates. So by the time they get there, these things are sorted. And it's the kind of thing you do when you're 20 and you think you're going to live forever.
Well, yeah. And the other thing was Buddy was looking out for his guys, the kids in the band. How did it come to happen that it was Richie Valens and the Big Bopper who took those seats and not his bandmates?
Well, Waylon Jennings, who was playing bass, the great Waylon Jennings, rest in power, who was playing bass for Buddy at this time. And the famous story is that there was an argument about who was going to get to fly on this four-seat plane. And Waylon was shy about flying. He'd flown before and he didn't like it. And so he actually gave up his seat to the Big Bopper. And I think Richie was always planning to be on that plane, but it may have been another one of those things where it was a little bit of sort of like, okay, we'll draw straws and whoever gets the short straw gets to be on the plane. And Buddy had said he was going to do that. He was just going to do that. And there were three other seats. And that's including the pilot. So that's how that happened. There was, you know, somebody like Tommy Alsup or Waylon. Waylon looked back and felt tremendously conflicted about the fact that on the sake of a 5-second decision, Waylon was off that plane and Buddy was on that plane.
Chris, this is the first of what unfortunately will be many rock and roll tragic deaths. There will be future plane crashes, not least the one which kills Otis Redding. There will be overdoses. There will be accidents. There will be car crashes. What strikes me looking back at this one, as with so many of those later rock and roll deaths, is how preventable it appears to be when you look at the weather conditions the plane takes off in, when you look at the inexperience of the pilot, who apparently doesn't even want to fly it, who tries to get a more experienced pilot to take his gig.
Yeah, it's being a road musician is hard work. Clifford Brown died in a car crash. Bessie Smith died in a car crash. People touring in the South were arrested or beaten or imprisoned. Being a working musician is hard lines. And at this period, particularly with this sort of boom that, you know, we're looking at a record business that's populated by people who had maybe been making decisions for companies since the 1920s or 30s. And so with this new youth boom of music, there's not a lot, they haven't really scaled up. The record companies haven't really scaled up to think, oh, we should have a good bus, or we should have an experienced pilot, or we should book days off in the tour, or we should try to take care of the physical health and well-being and safety of these artists because none of those companies were investing for a 40-year career because nobody thought rock and roll would last 40 or 60 years. And so, you know, corporations cut corners and people suffer.
Per what Tom was saying regarding the pilot trying to wriggle out of taking this journey, was it that the conditions were really bad or that he was inexperienced or kind of a combination of all those factors?
Yeah, well, I had not heard that anecdote about the pilot preferring not to fly on that night. It was bad weather. If the weather conditions in the upper Midwest in the middle of winter, it can be snow or sleet or freezing rain. But what really is deadly for a small aircraft is that the cloud cover tends to hang very, very low. So you might get 300 or 400 or 500 feet off the ground and you're into cloud cover and you're essentially flying blind. What I did understand is that this pilot was not certified for flying on instruments alone. In other words, he was probably not experienced. I don't want to malign the person's name because I haven't heard this anecdote. But it was not good conditions. It was not an experienced pilot. The pilot was not certified for the kind of flying conditions they were going to experience. And it was a series of momentary, unfortunate, sad decisions which had a tragic outcome. I was born exactly 1 month prior to this crash. I was born in January of 59, so obviously I have no recollection of it. I will say another thing that your listeners might find appealing. There is an absolutely beautiful eulogy, kind of an extended story, by the American public radio host Garrison Keillor, who hosted a program for years called The Prairie Home Companion. And in his monologue on one of the anniversaries, one of the February 3rd anniversaries, maybe 1989 or so, people could find it on the web, he tells the story of growing up in the Twin Cities and hearing over the radio that Buddy's plane had gone down. And he and his friends, who were probably 13 or 14 or 15 at the time, he and his friends who had their own little band in emulation of Buddy, and they had like a toy keyboard and a guitar and bongos or something like that. They got in their car and they drove from Minnesota, from Minneapolis to Clear Lake, Iowa. And it's an incredibly beautiful, very sad eulogy for how much of a sense of possibility that Buddy had symbolized and how in the wake of the crash, there was this dreadful, heart-wrenching sense that those possibilities had disappeared, that those possibilities had literally died. So it's quite beautiful. It's quite moving. The news came around different ways. Maria Elena apparently heard it on a television broadcast, which must have been a particularly difficult kind of experience. It's really brutal, but yeah, it's really brutal. And you know, sometimes there are events in the lives of artists, even artists who are functional people. Like Buddy was a functional person. He was a good person. He was not a sociopath. There are these events, or Clifford Brown, the great jazz trumpeter, who's killed at 22 or 23 in a car crash while on the road. And you look at that life and you think, oh my God, that was a good person who was doing good things in the world, who had another 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 years of creativity and joy to offer. And we're not going to get that. And so about the only thing that I can think of in terms of any of these sort of tragic deaths of so many of these musicians who we lost untimely young, the only thing I can think of, the only way I can think about it is to think, well, thank you, Buddy. Thank you for what you did. Thank you for what you gave us in the time that we had you.
The giants of music thank Buddy Holly and Tom Fordyce, and I thank you. Christopher Smith, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy to chat with you.
Kate, I don't know about you. I really enjoyed finding out more about Buddy Holly because I think, do you know what? I think before I'd underestimated him. I hadn't entirely got it because he doesn't have Elvis's sneer. He doesn't have the danger of Little Richard.
No.
And that conversation has changed my mind.
Totally. I mean, the whole idea that he single-handedly set that template for how everybody could put together a rock band. He was kind of like the starter kit. Grow your own rock band.
He was. And to try and bring it full circle, Katie, to the story you told us at the start of the show, I found a little story about Don McLean. So apparently Don was 13 when Buddy Holly died, and he was doing a job delivering newspapers in New York City. And it was then, on that morning that he read about the widowed bride.
Oh.
Maria.
Oh, so he was delivering the paper and then
and he saw the
ripped
headlines.
From the headlines. So that would have hit him hard. And also it was just like being right at the portal of information, the fact that he had that newsprint in his fingertips. Imagine how profound and poignant it would have been for a little 13-year-old Dom McLean to be holding this information in his hands, like newsprint on his fingertips, and realizing that the world was not going to be the same.
Yeah, absolutely, Casey. And I think a lot of us feel that way about our musical heroes. And there is, of course, a crowd podcast all about this. It's called Death of a Rock Star, and we hope that it's narrative storytelling at its most immersive. There's episodes about Jim Morrison, about Whitney Houston, about Otis Redding, about Keith Moon, Janis Joplin, and there is one about Buddy Holly.
Plus, you might want to know, listeners, that our resident writer and master of the pen, Tom Fordyce, even wrote some of them. So give it a listen, search Death of a Rock Star and subscribe.
And before we go, a little elbow in the ribs, a reminder about the merchandise competition we talked about at the start. Casey, where are we going next week?
Slap on your toilet brush helmets and lace up your sandals and get into those chariots, because it's time for Ben-Hur.
Oh, what a film, Katie. I mean, it's very, very long. Charlton Heston is possibly questionable in it, but oh my, the drama.
The drama, the drama, the drama. And 4 hours of my life I'll never get back again.
Right, let's watch it. We'll see you next time.
Crowd Network. A place where you belong.
Hello everyone. My name is Tom Kearns and I host the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, where I cover the history and culture of England from the departure of the Romans in the 5th century to the Norman conquest in 1066. So far, we've surveyed the collapse of Roman rule in Britain, the migration of the Anglo-Saxons, and the history of Northumbria from its beginnings in the mists of legend to its destruction at the hands of Viking raiders in the 9th century. I hope you'll come and give it a go.
Our lives were never the same after we learned our 21-year-old daughter, Kristen, was murdered by her ex-boyfriend. It's a parent's worst nightmare. How much did we really know about domestic violence back then? Clearly not enough. Now we know plenty. We know domestic violence, or DV, can happen to anyone. 1 in 3 women suffer physical violence at the hands of intimate partners during their lifetimes. 1 in 3. I'm Bill Mitchell, host of the When Dating Hurts podcast. And my interviews with DV counselors, law enforcement, and especially actual DV survivors give the pandemic of domestic violence the attention it deserves. The When Dating Hurts podcast. It's a series of lives being saved.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.